Gosh, thanks very much, Satyadasa, for such a generous, warm introduction. That's lovely. It's great to be here. Great to see so many people here on a warm afternoon, not too long before the World Cup final. I was here before when I launched my book a couple of years ago, so it's great to be back. But the shrine looks very different today. The shrine is very verdant, and that's going to fit nicely with the theme of my talk, Dharma and Nature. That's a very broad kind of title, and that's on purpose in a way. It's a theme that I haven't talked about before, and it was a fantastic opportunity to think through the relationship of dharma and nature in preparation for this talk. But before I get on that, just a bit of scene setting. Today we celebrate Dharma Day, the festival celebrating the dharma, and you might wonder, well, why? What's that about? And the reason is it's the day after the full moon. That was yesterday, wasn't it? The full moon of the month of July. Asalha Purnima in Sanskrit. And according to Buddhist tradition, the Buddha delivered his first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, in the Isipatana, near the deer park in Sarnath, near Varanasi in India, 2,500 or so years ago. We don't really know. So that's why we're having a Dharma Day today, in accordance with this tradition of celebrating the first sermon of the Buddha. So I don't know if you could see the full moon here in London last night. In Cambridge, you could. It's so humid in Cambridge, we couldn't see a thing. In fact, I'm really glad you could. And at the same time, we're having this warm, wet summer, aren't we? Full of growth and greenery and buzzing kind of life. So nature's everywhere, turning wetness and light into leaves and laying eggs and flying about, very vivid. And so in the midst of this proliferation of buddleia and butterflies, I want to reflect on the relationship of dharma, which the Buddha started to teach so long ago, and nature. So we've got two big words here, just to think about words. Two big important words, dharma, nature. And we might wonder, well, how do they relate, just as words? The word dharma is, of course, Sanskrit. It's dhamma in Pali. We use that in the Indian part of our movement. And for Buddhists, this means the teaching of the Buddha. Straightforwardly, dharma means the teaching of the Buddha. It's the word we use for all the teachings and practices that were made known by the Buddha, including the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which according to tradition were first taught on in the first sermon. But the word dharma also means nature, in a particular sense, in the sense of the essential quality of things, the basic principle of reality. We talk about the nature of things, meaning the basic principle of how they work. Dharma means the same thing. So we could say the dharma is the true nature of things, but we also use the word nature. This English word, coming from a Latin root, in a different sense, to refer to the whole interconnected living world. The non-human world, we could say. The swimming, flying, running, growing, eating, fighting miasma of planet Earth. Yeah? And the word dharma doesn't mean that. Yeah? So we've got two words, and they overlap in meaning, but only partly. They only partly overlap. And for that reason, perhaps it's not always clear how they relate. And that was my starting point for thinking about dharma and nature. And another starting point for this talk was, of course, the fact that we're in the midst of a crisis of nature at the moment, a crisis for nature, with human activities beginning to cause global warming, widespread habitat loss, and species extinction. They're like the three big things that are happening. So that nature is, as it were, in the sense of this interconnected, living, non-human world, is something we're now aware of as under threat. And I think it's important for us to ask, how can we connect up the meanings of Dharma and nature more fully in a way that helps us get a sense of what the way forward might be, what the solution, if there is one, might be? How can our own practice of the Dharma, first taught in the July moonlight so long ago, be a source of healing for nature? And I'm going to try to answer these questions in three stages. First, I'll talk about the Dharma as a natural process of unfolding of spiritual experience. Some of you this morning were exploring this very theme, so this might be familiar. Second, I'll explore the image of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. He's nearly under the Bodhi tree here, isn't he? The Buddha near the Bodhi tree here, as a symbol for how we might come into relationship with nature as an interconnected whole. So this is exploring symbolism. And third, I'll explore the traditional Buddhist attitude to nature and how we need to develop new ideas and approaches for our contemporary predicament and for our contemporary role as Buddhists. And I'm, in that sense, I'm going to end with some relatively practical suggestions. So, firstly, the Dharma has a natural process. One of my favourite discourses in the Pali Canon is called "Is It Necessary to Be Willful?" And if you read my book, it's in chapter 4. I discuss it. You'll recognise it from there, on the spiral path. And it just starts, without any context or any scene setting, it just starts, and it's the Buddha speaking. "For someone who is ethical, monks, it is not necessary to be willful, wishing, 'May I have freedom from remorse?' It is natural, monks, it is natural that for someone who is ethical and who is established in virtuous conduct, that freedom from remorse arises." And on the discourse goes, "For someone who is free from remorse, it is natural that joy arises. For someone joyful, it's natural that rapture arises. For someone rapturous, it is natural that their body calms down. For someone whose body is calmed down, it's natural that they experience bliss. For someone blissful, it is natural that their mind becomes concentrated. For someone whose mind is concentrated, it is natural that they know and see things as they really are. And hence, it's natural that they become disenchanted with perhaps previous unskillful behaviour. They become dispassionate towards distractions in their lives, and they experience liberation and nirvana." I've deliberately summarised this discourse, which typically of Pali discourses is intensely repetitive, as I just want to get across a basic point. Our progress on the Buddhist path is a natural one, a natural process of spiritual growth. A natural process. When we practice ethics, it's just natural that we experience freedom from remorse and the joy that comes from having no regrets, nothing hanging over us, is that freedom from remorse. So we don't need to make a deliberate intention. The Buddha says, na chetanaya karaniyam. It's not something that you have to do through an intention, a chetana. You don't have to deliberately think May I be free from remorse. You don't have to, if you are free from remorse, you don't have to make this deliberate intention that you'd like to experience life in a vivid, intense, rapturous way. It just starts to happen that way, whether in meditation or listening to music or talking to friends or even cooking or eating. And when there's this rapturous quality in our experience, our psychic tensions start to release. The body begins to calm down. With this calming down of the body through tension release, we begin to experience bliss and well-being. And this very happiness becomes the condition for the concentration, the concentrated mental states that are the basis for liberating insight. So all this is a natural process, and natural here means is a translation of dhammata in Pali, according to dhamma. It happens dhammata, which we just translate natural. It's natural. So no doubt this is what I've just said. It sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds good. It maybe is an idealised picture of the Buddhist spiritual life. In practice, it might be a bit more complicated. But there's an important principle at work there, that spiritual growth is a natural process, a natural unfolding of conditions. In another early Buddhist discourse, we read how states overflow into states. States fulfill states in order to go from here to the beyond. And this unfolding is often compared to the flowing of water. The Buddha, we read about this long simile that the Buddha gives. Just as when it rains huge drops on the tops of mountains, the water pouring down the slopes fills up the branching clefts of mountain gullies. The full up branching clefts of mountain gullies fill up ponds. The full up ponds fill up lakes. The full up lakes fill up streams. The full up streams fill up rivers, and the full up rivers fill up the great ocean. So in the Guide to the Buddhist Path, Sangharakshita compares this natural process of spiritual growth to the growth of a plant. So another kind of simile. We just need to care for the delicate seed of faith in the Dharma, whatever it is that brought you to the Buddhist Center, looking for some way of making sense of life. And an ethical sensitivity will begin to sprout just through your attention to the question of what is life really about. And if we care for that, joy and rapture and so on will unfold in the process of growth of the plant of our spiritual life. And in the end, as the Buddha says in yet another discourse on this theme, it's as if, monks, there was a tree flourishing with branches and leaves. Its bark crust will attain to complete development, and its inner bark and sapwood and heartwood will all attain to complete development. The word development, you could imagine a tree which is fully mature, I suppose. That's the image. But at the same time, that's a human being who is fully developed. So the impression we get from these early Buddhist teachings is that practicing the spiritual life amounts to participating in a natural process of growth. And this natural process is another way of talking about paticca-samuppada, dependent arising, which is the Buddha's basic principle of reality, the Buddha's discovery of the basic principle of how everything happens, how nature happens. We were chanting just now a formula. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. This is the simple formula of dependent arising, which puts in a nutshell the Buddha's teaching of the principle by which things happen, a natural principle underlying pretty much everything. And perhaps you've heard about the 12 links of the Wheel of Life, which the Buddha also taught, showing how it's also, at the same time, perfectly natural that unsatisfactoriness, continued suffering and rebirth in samsara also unfolds on conditions of ignorance and craving. So I'm not trying to say that the Buddha was teaching that human nature is all about some sort of automatic spiritual growth. Actually, it's just as natural that we continue blundering along through ignorance, you know, not learning anything and suffering a lot. But nevertheless, if we do begin to practice ethics, meditate and so on, it's natural that we will begin to escape from that samsara. So, yes, in a way, Buddhism's not really like the New Age idea that, you know, consciousness is just in the process of development by a kind of universal process now that we're in the age of Aquarius. It's more that it's up to us as individuals, in fact, to choose which kind of natural process we participate in, whether it's this natural process of cyclical suffering or the natural process of spiritual growth. So, the Buddha's not at all suggesting. This is an important point I need to make to qualify the opening discourse that I mentioned, when the Buddha suggests you don't need to set up a deliberate intention for spiritual growth. It's a natural process. The Buddha, in fact, wasn't suggesting that you don't need to do anything. That the spiritual life just consists only in relaxing and letting the bliss unfold. You know, he wasn't actually suggesting that, because it doesn't quite work like that. We have to make quite an effort. We have to make quite an effort at developing certain qualities, such as mindfulness, such as loving kindness or metta. We need to make an effort as much as possible, really, to develop these qualities. And just through developing those qualities, our experience will naturally grow. That's the balanced picture, as it were. So it's a bit like we need to water the seeds of our spiritual development and weed the garden. Does that make sense? And then it's natural that our spiritual life will grow and become fruitful. So I'm moving on there to the second part of my talk, about the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. This theme of the Dharma as a natural process is, I think, nicely summed up in the image of the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree. So I'll give you a bit of context here. We're probably all familiar with the image of the Buddha sat beneath the Bodhi tree as being, this is the story of the Buddha's awakening. He found his spot, he meditated in that spot. But in the earliest accounts of the Buddha's awakening in the Pali Canon, in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, and in the Padana Sutta, the striving, in the earliest accounts, there's no mention of a tree. There's no tree. It's just the Buddha to be, he's not quite the Buddha yet, in a forest grove, a very pleasant place. That's all it says. Although he does mention he's on the banks of the river Niranjara. But perhaps that's because it's a really nice place. And what's said is that the Buddha-to-be is determined to find the deathless. He's committed to striving for awakening. It's a bit later that this image of the tree, the Buddha sitting beneath the Bodhi tree, became the standard way of thinking about this. And what this means is that we don't need to take the image of the Bodhi tree literally. It's a symbol, a way of communicating in the language of imagination. And when we do this, we can begin to think of the Bodhi tree less as an actual or literal tree and more as the tree of life. Yeah, a symbol of life as a whole. The ancient mythic symbol for life as an interconnected whole. And to give you a sense of in what sense this is an ancient symbol, you might have heard of Yggdrasil. Yggdrasil, the world tree, the cosmic ash tree of Norse myth. In the roots and branches of Yggdrasil, the world tree, are the hell beings and the gods, as well as the human realm. They're all in the tree. The human realm somewhere in the middle. And the sacred waters of life, they circulate through the world tree, Yggdrasil. And in this respect, we can also think, you know, just going back to the Buddhist story, of the river Nirmanjira as a symbol. Presumably, I mean, there really is a river Nirmanjira, we don't need to doubt that. But perhaps there's also a symbolic significance here, in the sense that the river Nirmanjira represents a symbol of the water of life, the mysterious living essence that circulates within the structure of the tree of life, within all of life's interconnected forms. I mention Norse myth because you can imagine it's a long way from India, yeah? There might be a connection between the two mythologies. They're both related to Indo-European mythology in the background. There might be a common ancestry. But it could also be that these symbols belong to the kind of universal archetypes of how we imagine the life as an interconnected whole. So I'm suggesting that the symbol of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree represents this human being, the Buddha, in relationship with life considered or imagined as a whole. So the Buddha's represented as being in the centre of the living world. And it doesn't stop there. In the Vinaya, another ancient Buddhist text, there's a story of how a few weeks after the Buddha's awakening, while he was still sitting around and absorbing his awakening enlightenment experience, it said that he was visited by Muchalinda, the king of the Nagas. Muchalinda, by the way, is the name of a kind of tree which emphasises the relationship between this Naga and his tree. If you haven't heard of Nagas, they're basically, it's a word for a big, powerful animal. So, in fact, we kind of, elephants are called Nagas sometimes, so we kind of had a Naga on our shrine, which is nice. But in myth, Indian myth, Nagas are typically like enormous serpents who tend to live underwater. I'll mention a bit more about Nagas. So, going back to the story, it said that a great storm blew up out of nowhere, and the Buddha's just sitting in the open air. Muchalinda appears from within his tree. He wraps himself seven times around the meditating Buddha, and he unfolds his mighty hood over the Buddha's head to protect him from the storm. Once the storm ends, Muchalinda transforms into a youth, salutes the Buddha, and disappears. So it's a very mysterious story. As far as I'm aware, there's no explanation of it anywhere in the early texts. But I think we should connect it with the Buddha symbolised beneath the Bodhi tree. Nagas in Indian mythology, they represent powerful indigenous forces of nature. They usually live underwater. They are shape-shifting and not necessarily moral beings. They deserve respect, and the Buddha actually mentions this a few times, you should never mess about with them. Never mess with Nagas. Now, is it a coincidence that there's also a Naga in the form of a dragon living under Yggdrasil in Norse mythology. And in all sorts of ancient Indian, ancient Near Eastern sources, we find the image of the tree of life on inscriptions and coins and clay tablets, together with an image of the serpent, as if they belong together. So the Naga, the serpent or the dragon, represents the powerful forces of nature, and the Buddha is represented as honouring them. Sorry, as honoured by them. I was just thinking, that doesn't sound right. But honoured by them. So, in this way, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, is a way of expressing how there are natural processes at work by which human beings can grow and develop. And these natural processes, the culmination of these processes are symbolised by the image of the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree, but in the sense that the Buddha's simply not got to the point of being a completely developed human being. He's also represented as having come into a full relationship with nature as an interconnected whole. This doesn't mean that everything that happens in nature is good or positive. That's not the point. But that the wisdom and the insight of the Buddha is at ease with, or even helped by, the powerful forces of nature, at work in nature, symbolised by the Nagas, fully manifested in the Bodhi tree, the tree of life, with the river Niranjara, as the circulating waters. So I'm going to shift to a slightly different theme here. I'm hoping what I've said just evokes the image of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree as a powerful symbol of the Buddha in relation to nature in the big sense, in a way that I'm not sure always comes out in Buddhist sources. But what about us, who are not, as it were, sitting under the Bodhi tree, who are perhaps sitting in a hot shrine room on a summer night, near the Bodhi tree, or near the Buddha, but not sitting under it? I'd like to invite you into a kind of investigation of your experience now about there's a kind of paradox or ambiguity about being a self-conscious human being. Maybe you're not necessarily being entirely reflective and self-conscious right now. You're thinking about listening to a talk. But if you could just become aware of the fact that you're you sitting there at the same time as listening, that will help. Just through being self-aware beings, we experience ourselves as separated from nature. I'm stating that as if it's a fact. It's something I'd like you to check out. You know, just by being self-aware, just by knowing that you exist as a conscious being, in a way, you know that you're not, as it were, completely just a part of nature. You're something which is emerged from nature as consciousness. And how we think of our bodies is a bit of an example of this, I think. We experience ourselves as both being a body and having a body. So we know that we are a body, that's what we are, especially when we fall over or we get ill. Yeah, you think, it hurts being human, being in a body. But at the same time, we usually experience ourselves as having a body. And it's by having a body that we do things through it. We sense things, we move, we go about our lives. We quite automatically might think, right, I'm going to walk down the road, go to the shop, buy some vegetables and come home. body go. Yeah? Our body becomes the means by which we do the things we want to do. It could be a very different shape. We could have, you know, three legs or two metal legs or whatever. It wouldn't make any difference. We just have a body. So often enough we experience ourselves as self-conscious egos who work through our bodies. And so there's the same kind of paradox, I think, or ambiguity in our relationship with nature. Nature now considered as a sort of interconnected whole. On the one hand, we're part of nature. Our bodies are formed through natural processes, out of the natural elements, and we're just like other animals in all respects, except with bigger brains and less hair. But at the same time, we experience ourselves very definitely as an I, or as a me, who's not just part of nature, but someone with our own desires, with our own ideas, and who is in that sense somewhat a bit separate from the nature we are involved with. And it's in this way that we quite automatically, naturally, as it were, we keep seeking and wanting satisfaction through this sense of I. We think, if only I could have this, if only I could have that, if only that person would stop being like that because of I don't like it. It's through the I and the me that we end up suffering in the way that the Buddha identified as being the result of tanha, or craving, which he said was the origin of our discontent. I was saying earlier to Satchidasa that I've got some ideas and I'm trying to link them up as I speak. So I'm hoping that even if you're thinking, well, I'm not sure we've linked these ideas up, you can let me know at the end of the talk and we'll see if we can link them up. For thousands of years, our ancestors gave expression to the nature from which we feel separate in this kind of way, by imagining nature as the great goddess. I'm not pushing these ideas on you, I'm just mentioning them. Nature is like a mother in that she brought us forth and gave us everything we needed to live. I think that's the origin of that way of imagining nature. At the same time, nature is dark and fearful because she takes life away again, and without the slightest care for us as individuals. That's the myth of the great mother, of the great goddess. And so as conscious beings, we're brought forth from nature, our mother. But then we live as self-conscious beings, a bit separated from nature, but aware of nature's power over us. So I'm trying to evoke, in a way, what it's like to be a human being as... You know, we're in a sort of slightly ambiguous relationship with nature all the time. And the great achievement of Western industrial civilization, we could say, has been to some degree to get, in some degree, we've got hold of some of this awesome power of nature for ourselves. We've mastered nature to some extent, liberated ourselves from some of this, the fearfulness of living in the midst of a nature which we don't control. So, you know, as a sort of Western culture, we've had a certain success in our self-centred craving. But the cost of this success, as it were, is exactly the situation we find ourselves in now, with human beings threatening the very nature upon which we depend. So, in a way, I'm trying to empathise with our situation as human beings, as being, as conscious beings, we experience ourselves as slightly separate from nature, as an I, as a me, as wanting to satisfy ourselves, satisfy our craving for some kind of being as conscious beings, some sort of satisfaction as conscious beings, and this, on one hand, is a bit of a problem, as the Buddha diagnosed it. On the other hand, is a very understandable and natural part of what it is to be human. And to a large extent, the motive force of Western civilization has been to try and to successfully extract ourselves from some of the painfulness of being conscious beings in nature, with the very unfortunate circumstance or result that we've ended up unknowingly, as it were, threatening the whole thing. So I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just saying it's part. You know, our situation is one which has conditions and is arisen through an understandable but very complicated process. And in relation to this situation, the image of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree offers us a symbol, I think, for our engagement with the world in which we now find ourselves. The Buddha, as an individual, and through his own efforts, has come into a relationship with the great goddess, you could say, symbolised as the tree of life, with the waters of life circulating through it, together with the serpent nearby. So the Buddha has ended the craving which sought satisfaction through the ego. And the Buddha's found release right there, apparently in proximity to, in relationship with the goddess. So this symbol of the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree seems to be a version of the idea of the sacred marriage in ancient mythology, in which the goddess representing nature and the god representing individual self-consciousness, they come into a fruitful relationship. So I'm suggesting that we could take the symbol of the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree as an inspiration for our own efforts to find a way to relate the Dharma and nature. To relate the Dharma in the sense of this teaching about the natural process of spiritual growth to nature in the sense of the interconnected bigger world of non-human living beings. The symbol of the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree symbolises a way to imagine the relationship of the two, and hence an inspiration for our efforts to think through how we might start to relate to our present situation in relation to nature. So now I can move on from that. That was a difficult bit where I was trying to get at some difficult ideas about self-consciousness and our separation from nature. So getting a bit more practical or down to earth now, or just reflecting on what is a bit more familiar. If it's true, and I think we probably all agree that it seems to be the case, that the basic principle of nature dependent arising is the fundamental teaching of the Dharma, and the spiritual life is a natural process, it should seem that Buddhism ought to be a very environmentally friendly religion. Yeah? It would seem like that should follow, shouldn't it? But actually, it doesn't really work like that. When we shift our attention from the world of ideas to the actual world, the picture looks very different. When I visited Thailand as an attendant to a Buddhist monk when I was in Anagarika back in 1996. Thailand's a almost completely Buddhist country, yeah? I was rather surprised to find that most of the country's forest had been felled, yeah? They'd spent the 1960s and 70s deforesting the whole of Thailand. So the forest monastery where I stayed was actually in the middle of rice paddy. And you might have heard of the forest renunciant tradition in Thai Buddhism, very famous, very inspiring figures in it. Well, that's just a memory now, because there aren't any longer any forests. So there's not any aren't any forests where Buddhist monks can go and wander and have encounters with tigers anymore, because there's no forest left. And this, of course, is what development means for a Buddhist country, just like any other country. It means making use of your natural resources and turning your land into productive agricultural land. So I think this points to a certain kind of problem, and that's that the kind of nature we associate with Dharma is an idea. We've been thinking about natural things and processes. We've been thinking about flowing water and seeds sprouting and trees coming to fruition, full development. We've been thinking about them as metaphors and symbols for the human endeavour of spiritual development. But these metaphors and symbols don't seem to stop deforestation. They don't seem to convert, as it were, into a way in which human processes of based on craving actually work out in the world. So there's something missing. And I think what's missing in Buddhism is some attention to the topic of how the Dharma connects with nature in the bigger sense of the interconnected world of living beings. How it connects with our attitudes to nature and the threat to nature in our contemporary world. So I'm kind of wondering, how would the Buddha, sitting beneath the Bodhi tree, have responded to the idea that nature is under threat from human activity? And the truth is that, as in the case of Thailand, the Buddhist tradition doesn't actually offer a great deal of help. And I've been reading the work of a German Buddhist scholar, Lambert Schmidhausen, who's written a lot on Buddhism in ecology. And he's noticed that for early Buddhists, nature was mainly dangerous and fearful. So that was a great challenge. It's a great place if you're a monk to go and spend time in nature to overcome your response of fear. But that's about all. Of course, the Buddha certainly taught the importance of not harming living beings, but this kind of gentle approach doesn't necessarily concern nature as a whole. It's more connected with individual living beings. And I think this points to the fact that probably for most of the history of Buddhism, nature, in the widest sense, has meant the great wilderness that lies beyond civilization. A wilderness full of wild beasts. A fearful place where it's hard to survive. Probably for, you know, the whole of human history, apart from the last 200 years, human beings have not experienced themselves as safe, as it were, or that they've experienced there being an infinite amount of wild nature out there, and as us needing to create civilization within them. But that's what's changed. Lambert Schmidhausen further observed that Buddhism mainly concerned itself with going beyond both civilization and nature, because both of these are characterized by greed and hate and delusion, the stuff of samsara. So the main message of traditional Buddhism has been about transcending the forces of samsara. Nature is out there, it's a good place to go and meditate, but that's been the extent of environmental concern. You can see an example of this in the way Indian Buddhism sometimes imagined the Pure Lands. The Pure Lands of Indian Buddhism, which were supposed to be very desirable. They're basically artificial civilizations. They're usually completely flat, with no wild or growing things, just jewel trees, the bells on which ring out the Dharma. All straight lines, square ponds, and tame birds. I'm obviously not making any kind of judgment about the power of these symbols, but the Indian Buddhists were clearly not thinking through how Buddhism might help us in an environmental crisis. And I think there's now I've got too many thoughts. There's even there's the possibility that the way the Dharma is being appropriated into Western culture now may even work against it, against us trying to respond to an environmental crisis. Again, this is just something for you to think about. There's a bit of a danger that Western Buddhists, inheriting Buddhist traditions from Asia, might suppose that Buddhism is about retreating into an imagined and artificial kind of world, or perhaps about retreating into a private arena of spiritual life in which we engage with the process of our spiritual development, but in a way without it seeming necessary for us to engage critically in any meaningful way with the powerful forces in the world around us. So there's a danger of our Buddhism becoming passive in relationship to the world. And in May this year, some of you might have been there at the international retreat at Adishtana. My friend Vantika gave a talk on the topic of going beyond capitalist economics. He described how he'd read in this Serbian philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, how he'd read Žižek accusing Western Buddhism as being the perfect ideological supplement to capitalism. What a mean kind of stab. What he meant is that Western Buddhists, with their wonderful mindfulness and their equanimity, are perfectly equipped to continue to be good individual consumers, well able to put up with the frantic pace of change in modern life, and less inclined to be threatened by the economic system. And I think Vatika was really stirred up by this and is writing a book to show that how this is not the case, and Buddhism does amount to a critique of some aspects of the capitalist system. He thought that Žižek is really parodying Western Buddhism. Although perhaps we'd have to look within our own experience to see to what degree there might be some sort of element of truth. But surely Vatika is right to be dissatisfied with this diagnosis of Western Buddhism. Surely Buddhists can also be pioneers of transformation within Western society. Through an experience of the transformation of mind and heart, through practicing the Dharma, we can at least believe it's possible to transform social attitudes and economic assumptions, which will be necessary if there's going to be a broad change in how we relate to, how we carry out our relationship with the broader world of nature. I think the Dharma ought to challenge some basic assumptions about how we relate to the natural world. We can no longer, like traditional Buddhism, just ignore the natural world, thinking, well, it's just out there, on the basis that it's an unlimited, vast wilderness, which we can't really do anything about, because it's no longer like that. It's under serious threat. We need to believe that there is an intrinsic value in diverse, flourishing ecosystems, which need some protection from development. And I think thinking like this, we'll have to engage the Dharma in a new and creative kind of way with the situation we find ourselves in. And I've got some more thoughts about this, although They're fully developed in a very nice little book by Akupa called Saving the Earth, which is probably in the bookshop. It's a Windhorse Publications book. I don't know, I think there's something uncomfortable, though, about bringing up this topic of the Dharma and nature. A lot of uncertainty can feel like it enters the room. A lot of conflicting views and opinions. There aren't any easy answers. What are these views and opinions? I think a connected pair of reactions immediately present themselves. And I invite you again to consider whether these responses are familiar in your experience. First, there might be the tendency to denial. That this means supposing, well, there isn't an ecological crisis or a threat to the natural world. We've heard of people who deny that there are such things as human-made climate change. Of course, we can't really see it. It's too big a phenomenon. It's too complicated a phenomenon. So it's easy to think, well, no, it's not really happening. It's just a worry. But I think the problem is that denial inhibits any kind of positive response. It inhibits any doing anything at all. And in fact, we all really know now, probably from, you know, I know from going to Thailand, you know from your own experience, that nature is no longer a vast wilderness. There are just a few remaining habitats left. And the human population of the world is still increasing. It's presently 7 billion. It's supposed to go up to 10 billion people by 2100. And so the threat to wild nature can only worsen. And the second tendency into relation to the ecological crisis is perhaps to entertain a fantasy that the answer is going back to a simpler way of life. A kind of fantasy about that. If we could do that, it'll be all right, surely. And I remember when I was in the Green Party in the 1990s up in Lancaster, somebody was talking in this way about what we need to do is go back to a simple way of life. And it occurred to me, hang on, nobody's going to vote for this. And in fact, there's no way of making it happen. You can't force people to go back to a simple way of life. What most people want is a civilized life, of course, like most of us have, with medicine, with technology, with the efficiency of our Western economy. And all the 10 billion people of 2100 will want just this, and why not? They'll mostly live in cities, they'll be literate, they'll all be online probably. They're going to know about what's possible. So without either reacting with denial or going into a fantasy, how can we face this challenge, this enormous challenge? It's totally unprecedented. It's not happened before. Nobody knows actually what to do or what will happen, in fact. But probably there's not a matter of there just being one thing to do. But there's the need for very many considerations and decisions. Now, on this topic, I think it's worth mentioning here that if you watch the news on TV or read in newspapers, they only report bad news. Yeah? And this really doesn't help us in working with denial or fantasy. I'd recommend instead doing something like joining up with a conservation charity, and then you get their regular reports with a lot more constructive news. You actually hear about what people are doing in response to the situation. I'm in the Woodland Trust, which preserves and restores ancient woodland in the UK, and you know, every few months I hear about a new woodland they've bought and what they're doing. I'm also in the RSPB, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, which is an enormous, powerful charity with quite a lot of political clout these days. And their magazine is always full of their constructive responses to what's happening. This helps us stay positive. So, assuming we've been able to slip past some tendency towards denial or fantasy, what happens when we manage to start to think about this difficult situation that we're in, that's in the world today? I think a couple of views start to pop up, and one of them is simple fatalism. The idea that there's nothing we can do. This kind of view, you might notice it in yourself. There's nothing we can do. The situation's out of control. I'm just one of 7 billion people, and there's some very powerful corporate interests out there. It's the whole collective karma of the human race that's unfolding. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. We'll see. I think, in a way, though, I invite you to consider that this fatalism is connected perhaps to a recognition that human beings, we're in our experience, we're often separated. We feel ourselves to be separated from nature, from the great goddess, from nature imagined as a goddess. And that leaves us in a situation not quite able to connect with the fate of the whole thing. However, even in the Buddha's day, they were fatalists, not quite in this sense, but more about karma. Everything that happens is because of your past karma. And the Buddha had a definite, robust response to this, to fatalism. His response was to point out that no matter how strong a certain force or tendency in the individual or in the world, we are always responsible for whether we go along with it or not. Always. We always have to make a choice. And the choice we make is what determines what will happen next. So, in terms of our attitude to the natural world, each of our decisions are always going to have some effect. It's always going to be worth thinking. We can make a difference. Another view that can pop up in relation to the environmental crisis is that there's going to be some kind of apocalypse. The world's going to end. Or human beings are like a cancer or a virus on the host planet. You heard this one? And for that reason, we're going to have to go in some dramatic fashion in order for nature to heal itself. It's very dramatic, isn't it? And the story goes that perhaps there'll be some global shift in climate that will make human civilization impossible. And it seems that a lot of human beings are prone to this kind of apocalyptic thinking. Do you remember a year and a half ago, the world was going to end, wasn't it? Because of a Mayan prophecy. Yeah? Remember the Mayan prophecy? And I know someone who had a lot of canned food under their stairs. My thought for you to consider is that this apocalyptic urge is connected to a recognition that nature, the great goddess, is far more powerful than humanity and indifferent to us as individuals. I'm hoping I'm connecting up ideas here. At a certain level we know that, but this prompts this kind of view that perhaps there's going to be an apocalypse. But the Buddhist teaching works against apocalyptic thinking too. If things arise on certain conditions and cease when those conditions cease, it's much more important to investigate conditionality on how things arise and cease again than worrying about the end of the world. We can individually set up conditions to develop our hearts and minds, and that's a positive response in the situation. So I'm going to return now to this image of the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree. With those views in mind, you can perhaps begin to see, I've mentioned the tendency to passivity and denial, the tendency to towards fatalism and apocalyptic thinking. For us ordinary human beings caught in ego consciousness, by contrast, we have the image of the Buddha sitting beneath the Bodhi tree as a kind of beacon to help us get oriented in this situation, in this situation of the modern world in which our relationship to nature is becoming changed. So if the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree were able to speak to us today in regard to our relationship with nature, to us as Dharma practitioners, what might he advise? How would the image translate into appropriate actions? So this first one is supposed to be funny. He'd say, switch to a renewable electricity supplier. He probably wouldn't put it quite like that. In the sense that it really makes sense for each of us as individuals to try and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, and one really almost effortless way to do this is to, and to reduce your carbon footprint, is to change to a renewable electricity supplier. It's very simple. I'm sure most of you have done it, but in case some of you haven't, go online to Good Energy or Ecotricity, and it'll take 10 minutes. Practice Metta Bhavana. This meditation practice is a very powerful method for overcoming this sense of separation between yourself and other beings. It diminishes the ego and leads to a concern for the welfare of non-human nature, and helps us engage with other people less oppositionally, less thinking there's a them and us. Cultivating friendliness is really important. Thirdly, don't harm living beings. This is just the first precept. It's familiar, but it has important ramifications. By making the effort to stop harming living beings, we develop ethical sensitivity. If we develop that ethical sensitivity, we'll probably want to eat fewer animal products. We'll probably want to eat organic vegetables. And these lifestyle choices have important repercussions for the environment. And we can tell other people about this way of living. Fourthly, live simply and communally. Living in a community reduces our use of natural resources, or living in relation to other people, continuing in a sort of quite an atomized way of each of us having our own house and all the stuff that we need to live. Living in community reduces our use of natural resources and helps overcome self-centeredness. And it's not easy. I live in a community, it's not easy. But life is not really easy in this sense. And it's important to live as sustainably as possible. And a fifth kind of word from the Buddha is go on retreat in the countryside. Isn't this really obvious? The tradition goes right back to the Buddha. He took himself off into nature, into the wild jungles from time to time to meditate in solitude. And there's nothing like a retreat in nature to bring us into a vivid relationship with non-human living beings, to remind us of our place in the bigger scheme of things, and to give emotional depth and meaning to our concern for nature. So don't underrate the importance of something as simple as going on retreat in nature. We've got some beautiful retreat centres in our Tri Ratna tradition. So these five ideas are quite simple and practical, but they're my thoughts about a foundation for the engagement of Dharma with nature. I'm just going to end there. Thank you very much.